Indie Media is DIY news. It is about people reporting their own news directly without the need for reporters, bypassing the corporate media.
There are 100 Indie Media or IMC websites worldwide providing grassroots reports of struggles, campaigns and protests.
There are so many people here who are saying no to the government today, and this is democracy in action.
Everybody's here. Everybody in the country seems to be here. They're just coming from all over the place. The banners are showing all the tiny, tiny little pockets of the country. Everybody has come down here.
The project started 3 years ago covering the massive Seattle protests which shut down the World Trade Organization summit.
Uncensored and unsponsored, IMC sites can be updated anywhere, anytime, by anyone.
The open to all nature of these sites means that you can publish your own reports about your own issues and at the same time connect to a global network of grassroots news.
What you're about to hear,
what you are about to hear are some highlights from these global websites and from our very own UK IMC Wire. For more information or to get the news direct from the streets, check out www.indiemedia.org.uk.
The world is waking outside my window. Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. Drags my senses into the sunlight, for there are things that I must do. Wish me luck now, I have to leave you. Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. With my friends now, up to the city. We're gonna shake the gates of hell, and I will tell them, we will tell them.
Hello and welcome to the show. It's the 4th of August and we're bringing you the usual roundup of highlights from the Indie Media UK and International Newswire. But first off, we start with a series of stories about evictions that are happening or that are imminent.
Evictions and alerts. Dorston Junction in Hackney was closed off on the afternoon of Friday the 30th as a large police operation took place to evict the popular and well-known occupied venue and social centre, the Poison Club. At approximately 3 p.m, the police axed down the door, roughly handling the occupants, immediately evicting them from the building whilst filming the operation. This raid was firstly justified on the basis of a drug search, then justified by a second explanation that the building was structurally unsound due to a fire next door the night before. The Poison Club was home to around 9 residents and has been in existence for almost 2 years. Described as a non-commercial DIY meeting point for friends of punk rock, the residents and users of the Poison Club also regularly facilitated its use as a venue for benefits and other events. The centre has also been a focal point for the queer punk community. The Poison Club is the latest eviction in a continued drive to harass and evict squats in the Hackney area. Meanwhile, an eviction was resisted yesterday at the Autonomous Lab Resistance and Rebellion when around 30 people turned out to support the space. Banners have been made reading, "Your community is ill, come together. We don't need permission to be free. Cars, oil, war versus community equality, diversity, ecology." The occupied space in Camden Town was opened in early June for the Greenwash, or US exhibition of resistance against BP and Big Oil. It has been open daily ever since. A series of events such as exhibitions, meetings, workshops, screenings and music nights have been taking place at the centre on a weekly basis. The Autonomous Lab is now engaged in resistance and rebellion and throwing some fun and games into the mix as well, A three-day non-stop bike protest running along a circuit around Camden Town has been called, as well as a series of local actions which include carrying out random ID checks on the local population in a solidarity action with the Palestinian people. Also, the Camden Town Apartheid Wall will be erected by the Zapatista Palestinian Solidarity Group. The occupied space is 50 Chalk Farm Road, NW1.
Meanwhile, the squatted Use Your Loaf social centre has survived an attempt at an illegal eviction, but however, they are now being taken to court. After 2.5 years of occupying the former bakery, which was left derelict 10 years prior to that, the so-called owners have visited twice the week before last to try and kick out the current occupants. The owners also own several derelict buildings in the immediate area and are planning to build a set of over 20 luxury flats. The police have also attended these visits on a number of occasions. The residents are saying that the owners wish to reoccupy the building and then let it fall into a state of disrepair, given that the Use Your Loaf squat is a Grade 2 listed building and currently they would not be able to knock it down. On Wednesday, July the 28th, the occupants received a court summons for a possession hearing for the building, which will be held on August the 11th. Use Your Loaf is at 227 Deptford High Street, that's in SE8, and if you want to get in contact with them to find out more, we've got an email here, and the email is useyourloaf@btinternet.com. That's useyourloaf@btinternet.com.
St Agnes Place community in Kennington is also under imminent eviction threat. Lambeth Council now have a date for the budget to effect an eviction in the street, and residents suspect it's going to happen very soon, but are determined to resist. St Agnes Place is the oldest and largest multi-ethnic community of its kind, created as a radical solution to the housing crisis in the 1970s, when a group of activists rescued, defended and renovated a street of derelict and condemned properties. Home to people passing through and to permanent families alike, as well as being the Rafastastarian international headquarters, St Agnes Place has flourished for the past 29 years as a dissident community and is now seriously under threat of being destroyed. Around 2 years ago, Lambeth started legal proceedings against 12 of the houses. By the middle of last summer, they had gained repossession orders on them. On October 24th, 2003, the 12 houses were said to be evicted, but the houses were successfully defended and a continuous occupation has been maintained. Thus far, none of the houses has been taken back by the council. Residents say it all seems like a matter of making money, not helping a community. They say the council has done nothing to help this neighbourhood. A press release from the community says, squatting has changed from being an ancient civil right to a modern criminal offence. At St Agnes Place, they have tried to protest against this. Lambeth will come again and try to evict us, this time with more force. If they succeed, it will mark the end of an era. This neighbourhood is one of the last stands to an alternative lifestyle in Britain. It is also our home. We do not intend to go without a fight. They are calling for people to assist the campaign and have announced the fortification of the street. For more information, see www.stagnesplace.org.
And yet another eviction of alert. 2 Mile Coppice, Weymouth, Dorset. A recently established protest camp to stop the destruction of an ecologically rich habitat has been served its papers. The eviction could happen any time from tomorrow. The camp is trying to stop yet another attempt by the local council to destroy an ecologically sensitive site, which is also a place to relax for the locals from the Littlemore housing estate. The 2 Mile Coppice is rich in a variety of trees, which includes pendunculate oak, Quercus ash, field maple, hawthorn, hazel, guelderose and holly. Areas under threat if this road were to be built are extensive and include the Dorset Downs, heaths and coast, and Lawton Valley, which includes ancient woodland. The claims made about the economic regeneration benefits of the road have been exaggerated, and no alternatives to a road have been properly considered by Dorset County Council. In June 1996, Weymouth Relief Road protesters set up Teddy Bear Camp in opposition to the brown route of Weymouth Relief Road. A decade later, on July the 12th, 2004, protesters set up camp at 2 Mile Coppice in opposition to the now approved orange route. Protesters at 2 Mile Coppice say they urgently need help. So for more information, please check out www.roadalert.org.uk.
Thank you. is the sad feeling of tomorrow.
Yes, sir.
Take Back the Streets protest in Edinburgh last Saturday. The protest, which began at 12 noon, had two starting points at Festival Square in the financial district of the West End and at Bristol Square near Edinburgh University. One of the protesters' grievances is that the Edinburgh Festival is a festival for the rich, where the poor, working class and homeless are pushed out of the way, and even, in the case of the homeless, pushed out of the city altogether. During the Fringe Festival, rents go through the roof, making it even more difficult for those on low income to find somewhere to live. Festivity should be all-inclusive. A person's pleasure and happiness should not depend on their bank account, as one of the flyers put it. From the website, it's time to take back the streets of our city from the cars that have too long been swamping them, killing thousands of people every year and destroying our environment for far too long. The event started a little slowly by 1 o'clock, the several dozen in Festival Square marched to Bristol Square along Johnson Terrace at the back of the castle, the fairly sizeable police presence brought up at the rear. The two groups of demonstrators merged in the square normally frequented by skateboarders and shortly afterwards went on a march towards the Royal Mile. The protesters numbered around 100 as they marched down Bristol Place to George IV Bridge. Blowing whistles and carrying black flags, they shouted, "Whose streets? Our streets, and people, not cars." Check out scotland.indymedia.org for more information on that.
Sherman Austin released. On Wednesday, September the 3rd, 2003, Sherman Martin Austin began serving 1 year in federal prison under terms of a plea agreement. Austin, the 20-year-old African-American founder and former webmaster of the anarchist website www.raisethefist.com, pleaded guilty to distribution of information about making or using explosives with the intent that information be used for or in furtherance of an activity that constitutes a federal crime of violence. The offending material, which Austin repeatedly has emphasized he did not author, was housed on an isolated section of Austin's web server, and a small portion of it contained amateurish instructions on how to assemble simple explosives. Sherman was released from prison on July the 12th and left Arizona for a halfway house in his home of Los Angeles, California. Under the sentencing guidelines of the USA Patriot Act, he was facing over 20 years in prison for bomb-making recipes posted on another site, which he linked to and was hosting, and decided to plea bargain for a year in jail and 3 years of probation. The actual author of the post has not been prosecuted. The nightmare hasn't ended for Sherman, however. He will serve the remainder of his sentence in a halfway house until August. In addition, Sherman will be serving a sentence of federal probation for the next 3 years, under which he will not be allowed to use a cell phone, computer, or other digital device unless approved by the government. Furthermore, Sherman has been forbidden any contact with anarchist groups who the federal government maintains advocate violence as a means of disrupting order and achieving social, economic and political change. See www.indymedia.org for more details and links to reports on that story.
And now another story from the global Indymedia portal, but this one with regard to Indymedia Cyprus. Now, responding to a publicity and solidarity campaign by Indie Media, the government of the Republic of Cyprus has been forced to admit that they were acting under orders from the US government to carry out an intelligence investigation of Cyprus Indie Media and one of its founding members, in order to assess whether he constitutes a threat to US interests. After a series of government lies and denials about the case collapsed recently, members of parliament were drawn into the public dialogue and shamed into taking a position on the issue. The Union of Editors issued a rare and scathing critique of the way the affair is being handled, demanding an investigation and a response from the Cypriot government. And now the Minister of Justice and Public Order has also been shamed into issuing a written statement admitting to the fact, including a directive to the police in polite words, which are equivalent to "get back on the leash." Police had originally interrogated the family of the Indie Media founder a few weeks ago, and during the affair inadvertently blurted out that the source of this investigation was a directive straight from the CIA. After a series of denials and cover-ups, the police headquarters issued an official statement last Friday admitting to everything that Indie Media had accused them of, namely that the directors of the CIA and the US Embassy had priority over the own domestic mission of the Cypriot police. Cyprus Indie Media, with the help of supporters and friends, and various alternative and radical community media groups, initiated a campaign for solidarity and legal defence and tried to publicise the case with all its curious twists and turns. Throughout the week before last, there was increased interest from newspapers on the island, which began to publish small news items about the case. By midweek, it had become front-page news with giant headlines in one newspaper. Recently, Cyprus Indie Media and the family of Evodakis held a joint press conference, which was attended by about half of the established media and, of course, Indie Media's own reporters. Last Friday night, the case was on the major news reports of two television stations. One of those two stations was the biggest in the country in terms of audience and also political power, seeing as it belongs to the state. During that news show, statements were made by a representative of the police headquarters admitting that the investigation is real and proceeded to uncover some of the details. By Saturday, the entire story had become a full-on front-page news item in much of the press, under the headline, CIA Orders Investigation. They published statements by the Assistant Chief of Police, admitting that there was an intelligence assessment investigation. However, they declined to mention the number of times that the police had denied any knowledge of the incident. By Sunday, the major political parties had got drawn into the fray, with members of Parliament telling off the police for their unacceptable behaviour. Even the Vice Chair of the ruling party was forced to criticise what he saw as the subservience of the Cypriot police to the US intelligence agency. And by Monday, as we said earlier, the Minister of Justice and Public Order was forced by the resulting public outcry to issue an apology for the behaviour of his own police force colluding with foreign powers. This story is still developing. There's a lot more information being released on this over on indiemedia.org. That's the global portal, and also Cyprus Indie Media. So you can check out that story and the previous story about Raise the Fist.com on the global portal, indiemedia.org.
I just want to add, I went to see an amazing film last night called Control Room, which was about the reporting of the Iraq war by Al Jazeera. It was a kind of guerrilla type cut, lots of shaky camera work, but absolutely brilliant film, and showed a lot of resistance to the homogeny of the coverage of the Iraqi war. Okay, now we're going to a track.
We'll be right back.
On last Wednesday, July the 28th, the human rights watchdog Privacy International presented their sixth annual Big Brother Awards to name and shame the government and private sector organisations that have done the most to invade personal privacy in Britain. The gold awards, in the shape of a boot stamping on a human head, were also presented by comedian Mark Thomas. The winners were chosen from about 300 different nominations. The number of nominations for David Blunkett, the Home Office, and the proposed National Identity Card far outweighed all of the other nominations. However, their unpopularity was not recognised at this year's awards because they've all received awards in previous years. So now we're going to... Last week we said we'd bring you some audio, actually, from the awards ceremony. We have the audio. Unfortunately, the language is a little bit colourful to actually play on FM radio. So the audio is going to be posted onto the UK Indie Media Newswire in the next couple of days. So you'll be able to check out the full audio of that with quite a lot of good comedy from Mark Thomas. But as we said, the language was a little blue. So we're going to run through now some of the different... different nominations and the categories and runners-up. For the category of the worst public servant, the winner was the Right Honourable Margaret Hodge MP, Minister of State for Children. Now, Margaret Hodge has received numerous nominations because of her patronage of the controversial tracking provisions in the Children's Bill and for her determination to develop a wide spectrum of intrusive databases and information systems. Her success in reaching the shortlist reflects the judges' concern stemming from their decision in 2002 to give the Department of Education and Skills the most heinous government organisation award for its invasive activities. The runners-up included Catherine Courtney, Director of the Identity Cards Programme at the Home Office, and Stephen Harrison, Head of the Identity Card Policy Unit. It was the first ever joint nomination for a UK Big Brother Awards. They're largely invisible figures working on the National Identity Card Scheme and have actually steered the project since its inception in 2002. They were, of course, just following orders.
The most invasive company, winner British Gas, for its unfounded and cowardly claim that the Data Protection Act was the reason why an elderly couple died after British Gas had disconnected their supply. The hypothermia and absence of any duty of care apparently were secondary factors. Runner-up, Lloyds TSB, for unnecessary and possibly unlawful threats to freeze the accounts of customers who failed to attend a branch and produce identity documents. The procedure has been described by the bank as an initiative backed by the Financial Services Authority. Also a runner-up was Follow Us. This is one of a growing number of companies specialising in mobile phone tracking. The company proclaims that its services can be used to locate people for peace of mind, security or fun.
The most appalling project winner, the NHS National Programme for IT. The NHS won a most heinous government organisation award in 2000 because of its plans to computerise all patient records in a way that is both insecure and dangerous to patient privacy. Its nomination again this year reflects the gravity of concerns over these continuing plans. The runner-up for most appalling project was Vodafone. For systematic default blocking of all adult websites, the measure goes much further than the BT plan to block access to child pornography and involves any site regarded as adult in nature. The runner-up was the Safe Harbour Agreement. This initiative, drawn by the EU and US, provides a basis for the transmission to the US of personal information on EU citizens. At best, the scheme can be described as inadequate. At worst, it is a means of circumventing European privacy and fooling people into a belief that their information is being protected within the US border.
Next up was the award for the most heinous government organisation, and the winner, the Office of National Statistics, for its development of the Citizen Information Project that will collate and share unprecedented amounts of data on the entire population. The runner-up was the Department of Transport for its electronic vehicle identification programme, known variously as the Spy in the Dashboard and the Informer, an embedded microchip that will automatically report to authorities a wide range of offences, including speeding, road tax evasion and illegal parking, and which will also be able to track the location of your car if implemented.
The Lifetime Menace Award was won by the US Visit Programme. Privacy International has taken the unusual step of shortlisting a US initiative for the UK awards because of the almost total silence in the US over this programme. US Visit will fingerprint all visitors to the US from September of this year. The scheme is offensive and invasive and has been undertaken with little or no debate or scrutiny, nor has the requirement taken any account of the special relationship between the UK and the US. The UK government has been silent about the programme and has calculated every step of the way. The runner-up was the Right Honourable Charles Clark MP. Charles Clark was shortlisted in 2000 because of his patronage as Home Office Minister to the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Bill.
Boo.
Now, as Secretary of State for Education and Skills, he has responsibility for the children portfolio occupied by Margaret Hodge. His activities at cabinet level pose an ongoing threat to privacy.
Commenting on the awards, Simon Davies, who's the director of Privacy International, said the winning nominations reflect a broad and intensified assault on the right to privacy within the UK. There is a clear hostility within government to privacy and a general antagonism to it from within business. We have seen few instances where privacy has been genuinely respected by large organisations. The default has clearly shifted from privacy to surveillance. Almost all large government projects attempt to compromise the right to privacy. The proclaimed need for protection of children and the fight against terrorism is now being shamelessly used as the pretext for privacy invasion. We are seeing a race to the bottom where government and private sector alike compete to provide the most intrusive services in the most unstable environment for privacy. It has now become clear that the European Commission has adopted a key role in leading the assault on privacy. The UK government often uses the Commission's decisions and activities as the justification for its own privacy invasion. The need for an EU-wide Big Brother award is now overwhelming, and we will look at this option in the coming year. The Data Protection Act has also come under sustained and unjustified attack in the previous year. We have some faith that the new Information Commissioner will more aggressively promote and defend the law. For more information on this and an awful lot of background on these issues, see www.privacyinternational.org, and as said, check out the indymedia.org UK website in the next couple of days for the full audio of those awards.
Needless to say, none of the government departments came to pick up their prizes.
Thank you. yo yanguino pomba kwese shure nemberi.
Houseboat owners have stepped up their campaign against plans to ban them from part of the River Cam in the winter. The group Camboaters has produced hundreds of information packs promoting its campaign, Reverse the Ban on Midsummer Common Mooring. The packs are being delivered to councillors, the river authorities and residents this week. The campaign follows the River Cam Conservators' decision to ban mooring along Midsummer Common from the Fort St George pub to Eights Marina from October the 8th to March the 31st to try and ease river congestion. Currently about 15 boats are moored there, and the owners would need to find alternative accommodation for the winter months. The pack contains a poster and a newsletter urging people to support the campaign. Luther Phillips, who has lived aboard his boat Corn Dolly for 2 years, says the restriction was put in place under the guise of a so-called navigational issue. But we feel the process in which the problem was investigated was not only flawed, but took place far too quickly. And with no proper safe place for us to go, we will effectively be made homeless. Professor Michael Chisholm, chairman of the Conservators, said a proper consultation was carried out and the decision would not be changed. But he said the Conservators did support the Camboaters' calls for an area of off-river mooring. He said, "We think the City Council does need to recognise an area of off-river mooring, and in principle, we would support that." The Camboaters' campaign, which will run for 10 weeks until the ban is in place, was launched last Friday when they unveiled a huge protest banner at the finish of the town bumps. They will also be launching a website, which is www.camboaters.co.uk, and the boat owners will stage an open boat day on August 22nd, when a variety of craft will be open to the public. "We want to promote the campaign and dispel the myths widely held about liverboards," said Mr. Phillips. And more green news. Lewisham Council has given the go-ahead for the construction of a four-storey housing development, along with other buildings, a car park and access road right in the park. A significant part of Deptford Park is going to be made into a private car park with a new access road through the park, which will run alongside the children's play area, bringing traffic into the heart of the park. Deptford Park is the only open green space between Southwark Park and Greenwich Park in southeast London.
A demo took place last Sunday at HMP Forest Bank in Salford in support of the refugees and migrants detained there following riots at Harmondsworth Detention Centre. This was part of a national weekend of action opposing the government's racist and oppressive asylum and immigration policy. 50 people turned up this Sunday to make a noise outside the prison. The person who posted this report was there to support the people moved from Harmondsworth following the death of a detainee and subsequent riots. Using pots, pans and whistles and a samba band, they tried to get the noise over the 7-metre-high wall so that people inside would hear and know there was people outside in solidarity. Also, various people involved in campaigning for refugees gave talks about the conditions inside detention centres. This is part of a national weekend of actions for those imprisoned following the riots at Harmondsworth. On the Saturday, demonstrations took place in Liverpool, Oxford and Dover. On Sunday, along with Forest Bank, a demo took place at Dan Gravel Removal Centre.
And we have a report from that protest, the Dungavel Detention Centre, which, as said, was a demonstration on Sunday the 1st of August. A number of coaches and vehicles left central Glasgow afternoon for the 20-mile drive to the notorious custody centre, which was also the scene of a tragic suicide on Friday the 23rd of July. It was a sunny, humid day. The demonstrators arrived at the centre at around 1:15 and began a two-hour protest. Outside of the centre, a big blue sign saying Premier Detention Services looked for all the world like a sign advertising a hotel entrance. However, of course, Dungavel is no hotel, being surrounded by 15-foot-high razor wire fences. Placards read "End the shame, no more deaths, and end detention now," as well as "Scotland unite to challenge racism." Chants were "No borders, no nation, stop the deportation." Many of the protesters banged noisily on the outer fence, and some took photographs by the main entrance door, ignoring the camera's prohibited sign. The police who were on hand took a very low-key approach. Banners of organisations present included Glasgow Campaign to Welcome Refugees and the National Coalition of Anti-Deportation Campaigns. There was also a banner promoting the European Social Forum to be held in London this October. Mark Brown, the secretary of the Glasgow Campaign to Welcome Refugees, said that MSP Sandra White and lawyer Aima Anwar had been given permission to enter the centre and would be allowed to speak to the detainees. He called for a minute's silence for the recent suicide victim at the centre, and then there followed a set of speakers. The first speaker was Caroline Leckie, MSP of the Scottish Parliament, who said that Dungavel was Scotland's Guantanamo Bay. She also said the Scottish Parliament didn't have the power to shut it down, but that ordinary people could by taking their own action. She also expressed condolences for the two asylum seekers who, as mentioned previously, died last week at Dungavel and at Harmersworth in West London. The demonstration ended with large chants of "Shut it down, shut it down."
About indie media cinema in Brixton. Coming up at 8 p.m. on Tuesday, August the 10th, is The Great Dance, filmed through the eyes of Nikati, a hunter and one of the Kalahari Desert Bushmen. The Great Dance follows the life of him as a hunter and tracker. It's a raw and poignant story of his survival as told in his own words. Its use of specially adapted minicam technology and never seen before footage of the death-defying chasing hunt for which Kalahari Desert Bushmen are famous makes this a unique and remarkable cinematic experience. Being San fills the social and political background to the lives of the Bushmen today. It is intimately connected to the first film because it follows a San couple following the Great Dance to other Bushmen. It's a rare, humbling and inspiring opportunity to see the reaction of people portrayed in the film. Plus speakers and a short film from Survival International on the current situation of San Bushmen and other Indigenous people.
Okay, that's about it for today. Is it? No.
No, we're running out of time, but we just had time to say briefly two bits of free party news. Over in Prague, the Czech Tech, which happened last weekend, drew 30,000 people for a several-day techno music festival, which all passed off relatively peacefully until the end, where it was raided by Czech riot police. Here in the UK, on the same weekend, there was an enormous free party put on by the Druids of Chaos, which saw 15 different sound systems out and about and having it in the woods for one of the biggest free parties that's been seen this summer, and that passed off peacefully with the police seemingly unable to stop the party going ahead.
Okay, sorry about that. That's all from us. We're going out with our outro now. We hope you enjoy. Please listen next week. And in the meantime, please post your reports to www.indymedia.org.uk. Bye-bye.
June 28, 2004, the Supreme Court of the United States ruled that the U.S. government cannot order the indefinite detention of hundreds of so-called enemy combatants from throughout the world at Guantanamo Bay without due legal process. Further, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the detainees have the right to challenge the legality of their detention according to the U.S. Constitution and international law. For those currently detained without trial at Guantanamo Bay, the ruling is an important legal victory and is also a victory for the many international campaigns against the conditions at Guantanamo and against the so-called war on terror, which the continued detentions at Guantanamo are a part of. Listen to an interview with Shane Akarado, a staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City. The interview focuses on the recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling concerning Guantanamo Bay.
We won the case, although the detainees themselves may not know it, and I think that's one of the more interesting aspects of the follow-up to the case. But let me give you some background to the case. As you know, there are some 600-plus people, all citizens of countries other than the U.S., detained in Guantanamo, including some Canadians. But there are people who were detained not just in Afghanistan, but hundreds detained in Pakistan, some in Gambia, some in Bosnia. We have one client who was an Australian citizen who was detained in Pakistan, sent to Egypt, and then sent by the Egyptian authorities to Afghanistan and thence to Guantanamo. So it's really kind of an international dumping ground for anyone the U.S. suspects of terrorism. And so this is a very convenient thing for the government to have in its arsenal. And the courts, when we challenged the detentions first 2 years ago, the lower federal court said that there was no right of access whatsoever to federal courts for non-U.S. citizens who were detained outside of the territory of the United States, even though they were under the complete control of the United States. And so there were a lot of technical issues to be resolved in this case about the status of Guantanamo. It's, as you know, leased perpetually from Cuba under a lease that was signed when Cuba was basically a colony of the U.S. after the Spanish-American War. And the lower courts had said that because Cuba essentially retains title to the sovereignty over the base, even though the U.S. has complete control and has it rented forever, that U.S. courts can't really touch anything that goes on there. And the Supreme Court, I think maybe not surprisingly in retrospect, said, no, this isn't the case. You can't have a little zone without law. I think one of the surprising things about the case was the margin that we won by. We got 6 votes and only 3 against. I think very pleasingly, the court left the merits of the kind of review that detainees there would get open. They said, you know, just that you have access to federal courts, but they didn't say, you know, that, well, it's a very limited access or we're only going to look at the facts of whether or not you were captured on the battlefield or something like that. They said, let the lower courts work this out.
Mm-hmm. Now, the issue of Guantanamo Bay, the continued indefinite detention of people from throughout the world, as you mentioned, has sparked international criticism of the United States. Now, do you feel that the decision which took place in the Supreme Court was in some way influenced by the fact that countries, even governments from throughout the world, have been criticizing the United States military policies at Guantanamo?
Sure. I think that's certainly been some part of it. There are a number of justices who, in all sorts of other decisions over the last few years, have increasingly cited to international law and to the practices of other countries with respect to international law, have cited to Supreme Court decisions from other nations. And so that's a nice trend. I think in the United States, we had a long period where civil rights were sort of something that was enforced by federal courts against state governments. And now I think we see a body of transnational law emerging, international law, that can trump what federal governments want to do when they are violating people's rights. But more so than even that, I think the Abu Ghraib prison scandal really brought home to the justices the fact that when you let the executive do whatever it wants, when you let the president and the military do whatever they want to prisoners without any oversight from a disinterested judiciary, then you get these kind of abuses. And that's something that we've seen throughout history from totalitarian governments. And it shouldn't surprise us at all that it's happened in Abu Ghraib and in Guantanamo. Of course, the Abu Ghraib interrogation tactics were basically policies put in place by people who had developed them, in particular General Miller, in Guantanamo for interrogations of Guantanamo detainees. And all that stuff became public a week or two after the argument of the case in April. And I think that must have had a great impact on the justices.
Maybe then could you speak about how you view this decision and also the intensive work which the Center for Constitutional Rights has been doing around the situation at Guantanamo? How do you view this within the context of a larger critique or a social movement against acts of U.S. military aggression around the world? How do you see your work, the Supreme Court decision, as part of a larger social movement?
It's a huge victory against this sort of move to militarize aspects of domestic society, that we've seen in all sorts of ways. Most troublingly with the cases involving even U.S. citizens detained here in the United States who are being held in military custody. And I think this shows that the Supreme Court, as it has for the most part throughout its history, is very, very skeptical about efforts of the executive to assert that we're in such a crisis that militarization of the criminal justice system is necessary. So that's, I think, is the basic lesson that I'm taking away from this case, and it's very encouraging. Although obviously we're sort of fighting a rearguard action here. We're fighting a tremendously reactionary set of actions by the government. But it's nice to know that the courts, even very conservative courts at this time in the U.S., are on our side.
You have been listening to an interview with Shayna Carrido, a staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. The interview focused on the recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling concerning the indefinite detention of hundreds of so-called enemy combatants from throughout the world at Guantanamo Bay. June 28, 2004 ruling outlined that the United States cannot order the indefinite detention of Guantanamo detainees without due process, and that the detainees have the right to challenge the legality of their detention in court, according to the U.S. Constitution and international law. To get more information about the Center for Constitutional Rights, visit www.ccr-ny.org. That's www.ccr-ny.org. This interview has been recorded and produced for CKUT Radio in Montreal by Stefan Christophe.
Bush Team Meets, New York City, August 29th, 2004.
Did you ever want to change the course of history? Be part of something so important, so dramatic, it actually changes the course of human events?
You can when you join the millions and say
no to the lies.
No to the wars for empire.
No to the disregard for the health of our planet and the people who live on it.
No to patriarchs and the attacks on civil rights.
No to the packed judiciary and stolen elections.
No to repression of Arabs, Muslims, and South Asians.
No to the global destruction of women's rights.
No to tax cuts for the rich.
No to the religious religious right controlling our private lives.
No to Bush and everything he represents.
No way.
No how.
No more.
Just no. More than a million in the street saying yes.
Yes to another course.
Yes to another future.
This is the time to make history with the most massive outpouring of resistance ever.
Be in New York City August 29th and stay for the week.
Go to www.chicagonewyork.net for more information.
Nobody wants this place to be quarried. This is a national park, you know, and this place gets 40,000 visitors a year, Santa Moore and the stones. And it's really, really well used by people, not just in, you know, the Peak District area, but all over the country and Europe, and a lot of international visitors come. And, you know, everyone's proud. This is our national park. Why are our national parks being destroyed without government intervention? Stanton Moor is one of the most archaeologically rich areas in the whole of the UK. There's like, and it's not that big, you know, because it's been eaten all the way around. It's like an apple core, just been eaten by quarries. But there's two major ley lines that run through the stone circle, and one of them comes through the site. And we're constantly getting people coming up telling us how important this site is, locals and people from all over the country, because, you know, spiritually for people, it's a really important place. The Nine Ladies Stone Circle is, you know, a really strong, positive place.
So it's,
and people don't want it to be disrupted by these quarries. The Nine Ladies Stone Circle is just one of four stone circles up there, that and the King Stone. That's obviously the biggest and most obvious. But, you know, the quarry would be, you know, two football pitches away. Stancliffe moved in 99, and all of the trees here have got tree preservation orders on them, and they cut this big hardcore path right the way through the woods without, you know, permission. They were actually starting work.
Right.
They were doing it without the Peat Park's knowledge.
Yeah.
It was only because people, you know, had set up site here and alerted the Peat Park to it they could get it stopped. English Heritage have been working really hard to stop these quarries reopening. Yeah.
Right.
And in fact, they say Nine Ladies Stone Circle is their kind of model stone circle in terms of environment and surroundings. That's because it's so far from roads and just the way it is, you know, up on the moorland. And so obviously it's not going to be their model stone circle anymore if there's a quarry right next to it. The 1st of June, the Peak Park is supposed to be deciding whether or not these quarries can reopen. The High Court decides that these quarries are active, even though they've not been quarried for 50 years, then Stancliffe could move in straight away and start work. Loads of projects all over the country could start reopening without, you know, without stringent kind of restrictions on them. To
it would just be a free-for-all.
It's the most fantastic place I've ever lived and probably will ever live. So come visit, it's really close by. You can just hop on the Trans Peak and get off about an hour and a half away and walk up the hill and come visit, because it could be your last chance, because the bailiffs have been visiting. We know they're planning to evict us. They've got a climate team together. It's going to happen soon, and it's probably going to be, the leaves are out now, it's probably going to be before they fall again. So come visit.
Thank you. Thanks, Jimmy. Thank you. Here, up at the stones, you can hear the bloody machines going on the quarries.
Yeah.